was drunk as well.
Doesn't she?
She just keeps turning red.
You arrived at your destination, you're like in the middle of the, like, you felt it. So maybe if you're here Tuesday morning, I might go with you. I'll ask somebody to go with you. I think it'll be easier to find that way. So Indy was writing research support to, the brief was to provide research support to social justice movements, but then it became an NU-SJC relationship. SJC was doing, and is still doing, a lot of work on sanitation in Khayelitsha, in informal settlements. Khayelitsha, parts of Khayelitsha are informal settlements. There's a big issue around access to sanitation, particularly toilets. The city of Cape Town, as the mandated body or the mandated government, level of government that's supposed to provide these services, hasn't exactly been doing the greatest job. It's like, they provide potta potties. Potta potties, I think they're called. It's like, you know, those toilets you see at concerts.
Porta loose.
So I think the legal requirement is like 1 to 5 households, but then they're not well maintained. I don't think they flush even. They're chemical toilets. They're not well maintained. Some are locked. It's just there's a whole mess around them. No pun intended. The whole mess around them. And then one of the biggest issues is also safety, because they're far from people's households or houses. Issues like somebody can get mugged going to the toilet, or women are vulnerable, kids are vulnerable to all sorts of crime, including rape. The sanitation work, the sanitation work, even prior to the involvement of NU, manifested in a commission of inquiry into policing in Khayelitsha. It stems from this issue of safety around access to toilet, and then it became safety in Khayelitsha, and then it became about the relationship between the police and residents of Khayelitsha, which is completely missing, like completely broken down. There's no trust at all. A lot of lost dockets. And just, I think, some corruption. Generally, residents don't feel safe living in the area. People don't feel safe going to work. So then, I'm going to go jump a little bit all over the place, but I swear it all makes sense, especially when you speak to SJC. So the sphere of government that deals with policing is national. So it's the South African Police Services. And then there's that sphere. The local sphere, which would be the city of Cape Town, deals with metro policing, but they handle small things like traffic fines and domestic disputes. And apparently they aren't even allowed to arrest people. So the power dynamics are really a bit off. So when the Commission of Inquiry was called, the premier of the city of the Western Cape, Helen Zille, was obviously in support of it, because the body, the national body, is run by a different political party. But she didn't want the metro police to be hauled in front of the commission. So then she's like, excluded metro, we'll look at SAPs. So anyway, the commission of inquiry started in 2012. It concluded, I think, in 2014 or 2015. So SJC did a lot of the collecting of affidavits from residents, and they looked at all kinds of themes in relation to the police, like learners and the police, like what students' experiences learners' experiences in Khayelitsha around issues of safety, like gangsterism, like walking home, vandalism, etc. The gay and lesbian communities and their interactions with the police, if there's a hate crime, how do they relate to the police when they report these crimes? And it's a mess. All kinds of things. And NU, through Mandisa, who you'll meet next week, she's the head of the law center, and the lead attorney was the law, basically representing SJC in this case. And in the sanitation case. So NU's task was tasked with legal and research support for the SJC. That was the mandate. This changed in 2015 when we broke up with the SJC, it became better resourced. So they have their own research capacity, their own legal capacity, partly legal. I think Madison's still texting it out, but her focus, but they've got, I think, candidate attorneys helping them, the SJC. So it's her. She's not needed as much as she was before. So she's able to focus on the cases that NU takes up now.
Okay.
So in 2015, we shifted focus to urban land, access to well-located housing, and public land. The first correspondence that we had was with the provincial government. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the levels of government.
Not really.
Okay. So you've got national. So national is run by, we've had the most interesting municipal elections.
Yeah, speaking of that. Yeah.
So national is...
Things change in Cape Town a bit too, didn't it?
Huh?
Did things change in Cape Town a bit? No.
Except the DA one. So main political parties, the ANC, the African National Congress, Liberation Movement that evolved into a political party.
They've
been in power for like the last 22 years, since 1994, ran the national government. I think initially, ideologically, they were socialist-minded, but in practice, things haven't worked out in that way. So I think they're really struggling to straddle the ideology, the mandate, with what they practice, which is basically like full-on capitalism and the protection of the private sector and immersing themselves in capital, to personally and I think even in the way that they govern. And then there's the provincial government. I can't think of, I don't know what the equivalent would be for you guys.
Maybe council areas or, oh, well, suppose we know. We're particular in the north because we're ruled from Britain. But you would have a national, for want of a better word, in Westminster in London.
Okay.
And then you would have local assemblies in Scotland, Wales, and the north.
Right.
But then in the south, you have the Dáil, which is the, I suppose it's called the independent Irish state, you know.
So those are
Then councils, sub-councils of those, city councils.
Yeah. Okay, so the councils would be local for us.
Yeah.
That would be equivalent to local. And the different, the Scotland...
The assemblies.
Would probably be an equivalent of province.
Yeah.
And then national.
Okay.
So it's national South Africa. Province would be Gauteng. It's a province. The city of Joburg is in Gauteng.
Okay.
The Western Cape. Here, the city of Cape Town is in the Western Cape. And it's huge. So we've got 9 provinces. So and there are 8 metros, like the big city. The big...
Mm-hmm.
No, metros are at the local level. I'm sorry. I'll get to that. So the big provinces are the Western Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. Which other one? And I'm trying to remember, some are very rural. Mpumalanga, the Free State, all of that. So let's just focus on Gauteng and the Western Cape.
Okay.
So Gauteng, like I said, is where the city of Johannesburg is. That's local and a metro. And Cape Town is where is in the Western Cape. That's another metro. KZN, Etiquini, where Durban is, would be another metro. So these are like the more urban...
Yeah.
Kind of money municipalities or local governments. I'll give a little brief. I'm sure Gavin will explain this a lot better. So anyway, our engagement started with the province, the Western Cape, one of the provincial departments. So province has, and I'm guessing different provinces have different departments. So you have the Department of Dealing with housing, for example. You have the department, the National Department of Human Settlements, that deals with housing.
Okay.
Then you have the Provincial Department of Human Settlements. Then you have the Human Settlements Directorate at the local level. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So money flows from Treasury to National, to Province, to City.
Mm-hmm.
In some instances, it flows from Treasury to Province to City.
Mm-hmm.
So you can skip National, depending on the service provided.
And how do the... Where do the priorities get decided then? That's your job.
So the priorities, the metros in particular are given quite a lot of power, so they can set the priorities through what we call the IDP process, the the integrated development plan process, which is what we're going through now. In fact, Martha, mm-hmm. I'll send you a draft of our contribution to the ITP process, mm-hmm. which happens once every 5 years, like after an election cycle, but reviewed okay. annually to okay. see if like targets have been met and all of that at the local level. So the custodian of land is the Department of Transport and Public Works. Don't ask me. It's custodian of land. So that was our engagement with the province. We started engaging with the Department of Public Works as the holder of the Tafelberg site at Sea Point. And this is how Reclamicity comes into the mix. I'll tell you how it was birthed. So Zaki, who is an associate director, came in one day. He's like, did you guys know that there are 4 parcels of land that have actually been earmarked to be sold in the city center? They've been earmarked to be sold to the private sector. They're basically advertising them for sale. And this conversation came from a letter that SJC, NU, and an organization called EE, Equal Education. Mm-hmm. I'll introduce you on Tuesday because they're all in the same building. SJC and EE are in the same building. Wrote a letter in 2014 to the MEC, like an equivalent of a minister of public works, to oppose the sale of these 4 sites. One is Tafelberg and Sea Point. The other was is called the Helen Bowden Nurses Home. It's like an underutilized building. Another one is the Alfred Street precinct, which is like right next to you guys, actually. And the other is, there's a 4th one. So an expression of interest had been put out. I think they saw the advert or something. So they opposed it, like you can't sell public land, especially in the midst of a housing crisis. And housing is like highly litigated in South Africa. It's one of the most highly litigated issues in South Africa because there's a great backlog when it comes to the provision of housing, public housing anyway. And
is that any mostly individuals litigating against the state, or is that organizations?
It's usually organized. It's individuals, so it will be an organization will represent
with an applicant.
But it's not usually one person. It's usually tied to a group.
Class.
It becomes like a class action of sorts.
We're looking at something similar.
Yeah. So they wrote, and then the response from the then minister before the elections, before the 2014 elections, he said, no, we're very much aware of the value of public land. This is a lease. This is going to be leased. The sites are going to be leased and not sold. What did he say? Land is a finite resource, and we obviously want future generations to have access to it. Fine, and then it goes quiet. Everybody goes quiet. SJC and NU start focusing on the Commission of Inquiry. Lo and behold, 2016, we read in the paper that Tafelberg has been sold to a school called, it's not really, the reason, I'm wary of even mentioning the name because then it becomes you're not the problem. You just happen to be a casualty in this war, but it was sold to a private school. That's another problem. It's like you don't even like not even to a public school, but a private school, you know, called Phyllis Jow. And then that's when our lawyer Mandisa wrote a letter to the new MEC.
Just this year.
This is 2016, So there was a change of officials in 2014 after the 2014 elections. So that's why I keep saying old and new. Yeah. So
did that happen? That sort of guarantee about it staying public or at least being leased, that happened in an old?
Yeah, so the lease conversation happened pre-election.
Yeah, okay.
Pre-2014
election.
And then this one happened post, So the minister then, who was the minister of the MEC then? I forget. But the current one is Minister Donald Grant for Public Works. So wrote a letter. We got a very snarky email back from them. I don't remember what they say. Basically, it's a, like we know what's good. We know what's best. We don't just make decisions irrationally. And I think in her correspondence, she'd asked what the plan was with the other 3 sites. We note that this one's been sold. So what's the plan with the other 3 that we spoke about in 2014? Yeah. And then he's, and then I don't remember what he said in relation to those three, but it's like, we haven't decided yet what's going to happen with the other three. So January 2016, things moved very quickly. Reclaim this. So we started going out campaigning now, going out into the streets, talking to people around access to public housing, social housing, you know, the dynamics of the city. Basically, you still find very much that the wealthy and predominantly white community are based in the well-located areas, the city center, the C point. And I think this is all within like about a 5 kilometer radius, like city center, C point, Woodstock, observatory, and all of that. Very beautiful, well-resourced areas, close to public transport, great facilities, like good schools, good healthcare, everything. Our black communities are in Khayelitsha, where you'll be tomorrow, and out, like further out, and people spend exorbitant amounts of money in, to commute into town, because a lot of a large section of the population works in the city center, and people don't even earn enough most of the time to have a car, you know, and they have to use shitty public transport, you know, trains that are delayed, buses that where people have to wake up at 4 a.m. to get to work at 8 a.m. It's a mess. So so it was kind of easy to build a movement around this this issue. And on the 13th of February, we launched Reclaim the City with the help of like students from UCT and all of that. And the turnout was really good. So the dynamic between NU and Reclaim the City is very difficult, because the concept is for Reclaim the City to be independent. But, and for NU to provide the organizing, research, and legal support. But because we are the fully staffed people, and everybody else is a volunteer, you kind of find yourself taking on.
It's a bit similar to some of what we do. PPR is the organization, but the campaigns evolve and sort of independently. They use an approach that we have, but the campaigns evolve around the people. Most people are volunteers.
Okay, so but then how do your campaigns, like, would you have a campaign? And this is another thing that we're kind of trying to work through, is Reclaim the City a social movement, or is it just, a campaign. Of volunteers?
They're all driven by groups, that's the thing. They're driven by the individuals affected by the issues.
Okay.
So they're the ones that strategize and deliberate on what tactics are going to be and what priorities are and all of that. So that's how PPR facilitates, provides the human rights frameworks and all of that policy support that might be useful.
Okay.
And tactical and media intervention, all that type of stuff.
When do you step back?
That's the juggling act.
Yeah.
How much capacity can be built?
Yeah.
Marissa was involved in a group, and now she's on the board. She's my boss.
It's tough. I mean, but that's, I wish you can't separate them. You know, you can't separate just sort of the mechanics of this with the work of it. Like, you know, I don't even want to say, let's not talk about this right now, because it's equally as important, like just that juggling act. And the newness of the campaign. One of my own personal views is that, like, organizations like Equal Education, where it's all very tame. So I used to work for EE. I worked there for 3 years. An organization like EE has campaigns, but everything always comes back to EE, right? And EE had time to establish those campaigns, had time to build itself up and build the campaigns up. So everything kind of, even though it's still a bit difficult, is slightly more fluid, you know, easily distinguishable, if that's a word. Like, it's easier to explain, to talk to know the structures, to know this. With Reclaim the City and NU, it's difficult in the sense that we didn't have the privilege, I guess, of that time to set something up, to build a campaign, to build a movement, or to mobilize people, because there was also all this other stuff happening in parallel, court cases, research produced, organizing. So, like, Reclaim the City's launched on the 13th of February. By the 24th of February, we now have applicants to a court case. You know, like, you've still got like 80 or so members of the campaign, but you haven't really had a chance to engage, you haven't had a chance to work through the kinks, you haven't had a chance to do the whole popular education element of things. So these things have to run parallel, but then you're also not like a huge organization that can be split in that way, that, oh, you guys can focus on this explicitly and the rest of us will focus on building this. Yeah. So it's things like that. Anyway, let's park that for a while. So then we launched a court application with some members of the campaign in late February to put an interdict on the sale. So the site had been sold. This is Tafel Manila. We're focusing specifically on Tafel. The site had been sold but had not yet been transferred.
Yeah.
So interdict, halt the transfer is what we were saying.
What's that? So what's it called? The intervention one? Are you looking at an interdict?
Interdict.
Interdict.
Yeah.
We need a few of those as well.
Let's halt. Don't transfer the site until you. Let me just backtrack a little bit. So they said that the province said it had sold the site because it was surplus to service delivery needs.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so then the case for the interdict was the rationale behind the surplus declaration. Like, where did you decide? What assessments did you do to determine that the site isn't needed for housing when we're in the midst of a housing crisis? That was one of the reasons. Oh yes, the other one I haven't looked at these in a while. The other one was, what is your plan in terms of the disposal of your assets? Do you just dispose when you wake up on a Tuesday and then you decide to sell a site, or do you have a long-term plan? And can we have access to those documents? I think that was our first request. Can we have access? You need to access them through PIA. PIA is the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So
freedom of information.
So usually you can request it. PIA is suddenly being thrown out there quite a lot by government departments of late. But I think previously you could ask the government department, can I have this? And be able to send it. But lately, because of there's a lot of friction between civil society organizations and the state, all levels of state. So usually you'll get go through PIA. And PIA, so you fill in this form, the relevant department has 30 days to respond, but they have 30 days initially. Or they can respond within 30 days, but if they'd like, it can be extended to 60. And if they'd like, they can say no. So you can do this, you can play this game for years, apparently, so when Mandisa received that response about PIA, that's when we decided to launch, because we knew that we could play this game forever. And then in March, this one, it moves to open, in March, the province came back to us to say they'd like to get a mediator into the room so we can discuss.
See the launch that you're talking about?
Yeah.
What was that? What shape did that take then? What did you...
Okay, what shape
was did it? Was it 1,000 people? Or was it just the launch of a document?
Okay, so we put together a document that outlines the housing strategy in Cape Town. Right?
Yeah.
And then it was very much based on the four sites that I told you about. It only narrowed down into Tafelberg later on.
Okay.
And by later, probably talking about 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
and that's what we've been canvassing on the streets for. Would you like a space to talk about these issues? And then we just put up a Facebook group. We invited people on the streets to an event, a forum. I think that's the best way. A public discussion about these issues, and that a couple of weeks before we caucused with the UCT students and the volunteers that came in through our little street campaign about what the name of this campaign should be, and that's how we claimed the name came through. So when we officially started setting up the Facebook page with come to the launch of Reclaim the City, this is the basis. Cape Town is facing spatial crisis, talking about segregation, talking about access to well-located land, public transport, all these issues. if you're interested to talk through these issues and about what can be done and how we want, how we envision Cape Town come to this forum. So that's the kind of the launch thing. And so this forum was supposed to be a monthly thing, and that's what we, no, it was a bi- 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. So we did it for 2 weeks just to keep up the momentum, because it was still so new that we knew that if we like waited for like a month to elapse, people would lose interest.
Yeah.
So we had to keep up the momentum. But again, this goes back to that conversation we were having before about who kind of becomes the operations of it. So it became this thing like the finding the venue for where this is going to be, the catering, the invitation, the, who sets the agenda in the absence of like a, an existing structure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when do we start building a structure? Is it still too soon? Do we kind of assess who the regular people are? Are there membership cards? Is there a membership fee? Like, we're going through this shit.
Yes, yes.
We can manage through all of this, through this court case as well. So that's how it, it came about. So, I mean, in terms of finding, like, getting applicants for the case, it was, it were, how many applicants? I think there were four or five. The main applicant was a woman, is a woman called Tozama Adenisi. And we've been engaging with her on a regular basis, like just informal conversations, like we'd go meet, chat, you know, like talk about C points. She was part of a coalition that existed way before years, like for, I think for almost a decade in C points, advocating on the TAFL website. And I think one of the ward councillor at the time, I think you call, yeah, you know, we're talking about the sub-councillor,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Had, I think, promised that the land would be used for social housing and things like that. So there was a rapport, and there was a relationship to be built. And they were like, okay, we're thinking of launching this case. Would you like to be an applicant so that you can talk about it from a personal perspective kind of thing? And what moving out of C Point with the rise in property prices would mean for you.
Yeah.
And that formed the basis of the court application. So application is launched to put a halt to the transfer in February. Mid-March, the province responds by saying that they'd like somebody to mediate between us, between NU and the applicants and them. But then they put very strict conditions, which apparently are the conditions. It's that's just how mediation works, that it should be confidential. The outcome, I think, is confidential, or the proceedings are confidential, limited to a certain number of people. Now, we've got, like, admittedly, a fluid bunch of members hovering in the background, and then obviously worried about it being a source of conflict. But we can't, the outcome can't be confidential. In fact, the proceedings can't be confidential. We have to go and tell people, like, this is what took place. Do you or do you not agree with the term?
Yeah.
So that broke down. So the mediation didn't happen.
And see, the provoking the province to react, was the launch significant enough in itself, or media coverage and all of that around it?
The media coverage is big.
Yeah.
The issue of land in South Africa is, you know, it's huge. It's huge. But I think this is another thing that makes things difficult. People have different conceptualizations of land. You know, it's restitution, for example,
yeah.
Like from the forced removals of during the apartheid years, during the apartheid era. District 6 is one of those areas where there's conversations around restitution. There is expropriation. There was, during this time, what year are we in? So earlier this year, there was an expropriation bill put for tabled in Parliament about whether the government has a right to expropriate land from a private entity or not, whether it goes against the Constitution, because private property rights are also, you know, provided for in the Constitution. The Constitution that also says people have a right to housing.
Yeah.
So, and then there's social housing, there's rental housing, there's RDP housing, which is free housing. If you fall within a particular income bracket and all. So people have different conceptualization of what land is, means, and having to kind of juggle that. So anything, particularly in Cape Town, I think Cape Town is unique in its kind of makeup, kind of elicits a lot of media coverage, a lot of publicity. So that launch, which kind of brought in a few journalists, plus this interdict was just like, damn it, can we do this?
We have to talk to these guys
now. So just to go back up to, and you'll hear it in Gavin's presentation, like he's so much more, I feel like I can defend myself by saying that I didn't study urban planning. So like the way I articulated comes through a bit messy, but we'll talk about it this afternoon. I'll use the instance of Johannesburg versus Cape Town. Joburg's inner city is more vibrant, more dynamic, more integrated. And again, I'll use the rate in like a 5-kilometer radius, right? And integrated in the sense of class and race. Gentrification is messing things up, but there are a lot of organizations. I wish we would be here in November, but we'll talk about that too. A lot of organizations represent people when it comes to like evictions from like. So the inner city in Johannesburg went through like this great slump like a couple of years ago, I think a decade and so ago. So a lot of the public buildings were sold to private developers for like next to nothing. Yeah. I'm talking about Johannesburg's inner city. It went through a slump, right? Those derelict buildings that were brought up by like for nothing.
Yeah, in like the 80s, a lot of the commercial kind of had a lot of them like more. I mean, Johannesburg was where all the big banks were, where the big mining companies were. In the 80s, they all moved down to the suburbs. So most big companies are now about 20 kilometers north of Johannesburg Central. There's a lot of like middle class white flight at the same time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say run down. I mean, yeah, you could say that like
it was a slum. Well, some parts.
Well, you could say that from kind of like a middle class white perspective, it was not what one would imagine. This wouldn't be like sounds like Sea Point. But there did kind of emerge some really interesting informal arrangements where people actually had a place to live close to where they lived and worked. Mm-hmm. Whereas that opportunity never really existed in Cape Town.
Yeah.
Non-white folks were able to actually get a bit closer. Yeah, they've always been kept out on the periphery. Mm-hmm. And that's like starting to change now. So, I mean, a lot of people, there was like a whole, like, what they called like hijacked buildings, that was a big thing. So the kind of owners of the buildings just gave up on the buildings because they were occupied by, run by like gangs. The gangs effectively ran these buildings. About 10 years ago, the government tried to kind of do a bit of a shake-up. And they offered massive incentives to property developers to pay like nothing for the building, like $100 for like a 20-story building, on the condition that they develop it, and the city kind of agreed in exchange that they would get rid of all the tenants. So the big constitutional Olympia Road, I think, there was a big case about that. So the city of Joburg set up like a goon squad. They're called the Red Ants. Right. Basically, like they were, it was like a paramilitary force. They weren't police. They were just guys like red with like mining helmets, red mining helmets, and like batons essentially.
What did you call them?
Yeah, the Red Ants. Yeah.
They looked like red. And there's kind of like hundreds of them would go into the building and just clear it out. They are still today far more affordable options in the inner city of Joburg than they are in the inner city of Cape Town. But yeah, very different history, very different. In Cape Town, the value of inner city land is a lot higher than Joburg.
The premise of this is that Cape Town versus Joburg, like that Cape Town is unique in terms of its.
Its
structure and access.
I explained a little bit today in
this
presentation.
Yeah.
Like get to
it.
Yeah. Okay.
So yes, I don't know what led me to that tangent about Cape Town and Joburg.
I don't know, we were talking about the state and the tension on the issue of land and how that provoked the reaction then.
So
your move on land in Cape Town was big news, obviously.
Yes. So
was them in the position to engage.
Exactly. And now another thing is the political party that governs the Western Cape and the city is called the Democratic Alliance. So,
was there alignment?
They are liberal folk with a very strong leanings towards capitalism. Very much like the market must, like, less government is best government kind of thing, you know. So that's their ideology. It's very much about like big business and all of that. So it's like, where people, if like there's a whole business that wants to buy this entire block, let it be so, because it's bringing in money, and this money can be utilized elsewhere. And that's the problem. It's always about the elsewhere and
not the here.
And not the here. Apparently, you can't be here. And all, like the people perceive it as being, although I think this is changing, they perceive it to be a white party. So race dynamics in the city are big.
Yeah.
So link that to land, link that to apartheid spatial planning, and you've just got like you know, so yeah. So that's why things have escalated so quickly, is because of how topical it is. So mediation fails. And then, okay, so we're going to go back to court. This is still March, going back to court. Then towards the end of March, beginning of April, they agreed to settle outside of court.
With one applicant, or is it?
Through these multiple applicants. How many applicants? It was Angela or Chazana. It was Sharon Daniel. It was like three or four applicants. Four or five applicants. So and the representatives.
Yeah.
So it becomes an NU province thing as opposed to like the actual applicants, but fine, we'll work with that. NU as the legal representation. So they asked for a settlement, and that settlement then is we'll halt the sale. This was the big thing, sorry. So there's... not a lawyer either. So the big thing was, okay, so we had the substantive argument, and then we had the procedural argument. Substantive is everything that I've told you about the Cape Town and its setup and its history and how practice goes against their very own policies. We have what we call the spatial development framework at, I think, provincial and local, at the local level. Every piece of paper that speaks to housing speaks about integration, speaks about densification, speaks about racial, you know, like deconstructed the apartheid city. In real life, obviously, this is not so. So there's all of that and the effects that it has on people, everything that I've basically said. The procedural was that the city, so I think every sale of a public asset needs to go through a public participation process. And in this instance, in all instances, in fact, it should be this way. So they're supposed to advertise in the newspapers, and then the languages of the Western Cape are Afrikaans, English, Xhosa. And they did so in December for a period of 21 days, I think. So our argument was, firstly, your time, you knew what you were doing with that time, because most people aren't here to begin with. The advert was like this small.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the site wasn't mentioned on the paper, of the earth number, so people didn't know where the site was. And the worst crime of it all was that it was advertised in English and Afrikaans and not Xhosa. So what do you say about your black constituents? Exactly. So it was the strongest basis of our argument, I think, and that's what kind of led to this whole, like, it was the media, that element. And that's what led to like the mediation offers and to the settlement, because it was very likely that the judge would have said, guys. So the settlement agreement was, we'll halt the transfer, and in that period of time, we will reopen public comment. We will advertise in the Xhosa paper, Afrikaans paper, English paper, and we will open up the comment period for a month. So this was from, I think, it closed on the 9th of June. So it was from like the 9th of April or something like that. And we worked hard to get submissions. We worked incredibly hard to get submissions. We'd already built quite a strong network from past, like our own work, from past work. But also, like I said, it's such a topical issue that all these think tanks that have been doing this work for years, we could kind of bring into the fold about, like, guys, here's something that's very practical that we could change things in a big way. So DAG, for example, made a submission. SJC made a submission. Who else? The ACC made a submission. The ACC did make a submission. ISANDLA made a submission. We got submissions from learners. We got submissions from domestic workers. We got submissions from religious bodies. From, I'll send you the link to the website, actually.
Okay.
Like with all the submissions. And we had petitions. So I think we got 950 written objections to the sale. And we got about 4,000 and something signatures on a petition. At the end of it all, and it culminated in a public hearing at Sea Point High, the high school. It's quite close to Tafelberg. And I think for me, that was it was better than the submission period process. It was like a testimonial kind of space. You know, people talked about their experience of space, and it's called, like, it brought in quite a diverse range of people as well. So it wasn't just domestic workers, or it wasn't just the working class, which is and that's the grouping of people that we've been targeting initially when we launched Reclaim the City, because that's the group that's most affected. But like, even like your middle class white people, your well moneyed white people would come in and talk about just having diversity in a neighborhood, you know, and this concept of, well, not even this, NIMBYism, and how that's problematic. Your property rates will not fall just because you have like working class people in your community. And surprisingly, some ratepayers actually came on board as well. The Greenpoint Ratepayers Association, BOCUP, these, like, BOCUP is like right next to you. Greenpoint is right next to Sea Point. So like a lot of support.
Why are they significant then?
The ratepayers.
Sure, it's okay. Probably self-explanatory.
Not necessarily. Ratepayers tend to be the biggest NIMBYists of all. You know, so we pay our rates and we bring down our property rates with these calls, depending on the location, of course, right? And also, it's not self-explanatory in the sense that the Sea Point, Bantry Bay, Fresno Ratepayers Association, which covers Tafelberg, I think the deputy chairperson wrote an open letter where he said, firstly, the state that's a bad idea, calling for social housing on that site. The state doesn't have the money to pull it off, firstly. Secondly, the state is already doing a social housing project in a place in Pinelands. Pinelands is...
Is that when you're coming from the airport at all?
Pinelands, yes. It's one of the off ramps. Yeah. It's not terribly far. Maybe it's like 10K. It's not terribly far. The site is called Conradi, and it's meant to be like a mixed development. But even that, Gavin will talk to you, even that mixedness, apparently the levels of the low income household housing is plummeted from like 49% to God knows what it is right now. But it just brought up the issue of, what is Gavin calls it, what about it? Like, what about over there? There's no need to do it here. And then his name was David Pollman. And I can give, we have like a hard copy file of all these clippings for you to read through. It's not good for the community. It's not good for the work. So it's like, what community are you representing? And note, this is not your land. Let's just get this straight. This is like public land. So that's why we were surprised that we got like some positive response from some ratepayers associations quite close to that vicinity. So that all culminated in a public hearing, and then the province had a month to get back to us. So from the 9th of June to the 9th of July, that's when you guys first drew. So you would have found us in the middle of that.
Sorry for that.
That was a bad time. So it was that, so during that month, like, I think we kind of look forward to every kind of down when the kind of the ball is in their court, because it kind of gives us a moment to focus on building the campaign. Because in the middle of all of these things, these very, you know, the submission gathering is a forum being deferred to another date, and you lose people through things like that. But anyway, so during that month, kind of, we had like public, the forum again.
like small little chapter meetings. So we started going to Seapoint more regularly and tried to build like a solid chapter and structure there with like a committee and all of that. And then, so that's happening there in the organizing side. And then on the 9th of July, the province got back to us to say that they are requesting further time because, you know, they weren't expecting so much input. We're like, well, okay, fine. to the 31st of July. And then on the 31st, they came back with a proposal that they will do a feasibility study to see whether social housing is possible on the site. Just to say that there are, I think there have been quite a few social housing projects in Cape Town, but they aren't, none of them in the inner city. One is in a place called Dromedaris, which is about, it's close to my neighborhood. It's in Brooklyn, which is about 9 km from here, 9 km from here. And it works. And then it's city level. So you hire a social housing, it's managed by a social housing institution. That's commissioned by the state, basically. The state has a set fund for the social housing institution to build, kind of thing, and to manage. But like, it's really, really low. Like it's almost impossible, like the funding that they're provided to properly manage a social housing institution.
And that's everything from maintenance repairs,
from maintenance,
building,
to everything from, yeah. So there's what we call, I'll send out a paper that Martha wrote. There's the RCG, which is called the Restructuring Capital Grant, that comes from Treasury through to province, down to a social housing institution, if I'm correct. And that's for the capital. That's for construction. And then there's operational from, and I think that's straight from province as well. And already there's a problem in terms of the money allocated for a unit. It's apparently much lower than what a unit actually costs to begin with. And apparently, like, social housing is supposed to, a social housing complex is supposed to sustain itself through rent collection. But the rents are already quite low. It depends on which spectrum you fall into. I think you have to earn between 1,500 rand to 7,500 rand. And then I think your rent is 30% of that amount of money. It's not a lot. It really isn't a lot at all to maintain like a block of flats. It's already a very precarious situation. But they look great, you know, they're nice. They look really nice, they're well maintained, etc. Things like that. So the province wanted to know if it's feasible to build a social housing complex there. And they said that they're commissioning a feasibility study. And then I think after they said that, we asked for the parameters of the study.
Yeah.
Like, first,
what's going to
be? Yeah, what is feasible? Like, what are you talking about? Like, what brief are you giving whoever it is that's going to do this?
Yeah.
Who is going to be doing it to begin with? And what brief are you giving them? They took a while to respond. And I think we got a response like mid-September. And they said it wouldn't be fair to give you the parameters because this is an open process. And it was put out openly. Like, we will commission the study and then we'll open it up to the public for comment for 2 weeks and we'll go back and revise. But if we tell you, then it kind of, it gives you an advantage over the general public. So we won't tell you what the parameters are. But it's going to be conducted by an organization called the SHRA, which is the Social Housing Regulatory Authority. That's where Malcolm, if you remember Malcolm McCarthy, did you manage to get in touch with him?
Yes, he is of Minas, yeah.
Are you going to talk with him?
Yeah.
He will explain all of this much better than I am. So,
does he work for them? Or
he works for National. National sources money from the SHRA.
Okay.
So actually Malcolm had met with the Premier to suggest that let us do this feasibility study for you. And then she said no. For whatever reason, well, admittedly, I understand why, since he wrote like a submission saying don't sell that site. but she said we will commission the SHRA, which is the regulatory authority, to do it. So there's a very close relationship between that SHRA and the SHRA.
Okay.
Yeah. So they are the ones that are being commissioned to do the study. On this side, we are doing like an alternative feasibility study that Malcolm is helping us with now, since he's free. And yeah, so that's where we are. We're kind of in this limbo.
Yeah.
Tough for birth. September, there was a case of Bromwell, and that deals very much with private rental stock and gentrification and all of that. So these things have been happening in parallel. And Bromwell Street is in Woodstock. And how did we come to find out about this? Like, and so it's like this, just this conflation, like it's just this fluidity that moves. So you can't even, they aren't like, oh, we did this campaign and then we did this campaign. Things just crop up. We found out that a group of tenants were being evicted from their homes on Bromwell Street in about in August. And there have been a lot of court cases around evictions by private entities and the role of the state to provide alternative or temporary accommodation in instances where residents will be rendered homeless, where there's a possibility. Now, the residents earn, like, almost nothing. Like, it's not a lot. It's for an area like Woodstock, because Woodstock is like on the up and up in terms of, like, it's gentrifying rapidly. It used to be a very mixed community, an affordable community for poor and working class people, but like, they are not even slowly being pushed out, they are being forced out. And then I think the response from the state, or from the city this time, not from province, from at the city level, was like, well, this is a dispute between private parties, and we have no role in this thing. Yet there had been a constitutional court judgment in the Johannesburg case that the state must provide temporary accommodation within a particular vicinity for people that would be rendered homeless. So then that became another court case that we took up. But I'm going to pause. We can talk about it maybe after you ask me questions related to Tafel Break, just to sort of give like a clear, we'll park that one. But we'll talk about it just to, when our minds are fresh from Tafel Break. So I don't know if you have any questions around that.
So where you're at the minute, is do you see the Tafel Break as the, like, thin end of the wedge stuff? Is that a success on the Tafelberg side as a sort of pioneering exercise on social housing in the inner city?
Definitely.
Yeah.
There hasn't been social housing in Cape Town's inner city since 1994. Like, that's the phrase that we use all the time. There has not been any form of affordable rental stock in the inner city of Cape Town since 1994. You know, when the party government starts looking like...
oh dear.
You know, like, things are really impatient. it would be.
And you've had, I mean, I don't know, what way do you quantify success? But that sounds like successes are happening there. You're changing the dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this conversation quite a couple of times. Like, what do you see as a success? I think it's not changing public, it's bringing particular phrasings, in my opinion, like particular conversation into the public. Like a thing that people are now talking about. People can say gentrification and know what that means. People can talk about well-located public housing. Like, it's kind of reshifting the public imagination. I think we'd all stuck to the status quo a lot. We could talk about the provision of taps and the provision of toilets, all very important, of course, and the provision of education and all of these things. But very much housing on the periphery. Like, so when are you going to address this housing backlog? When are you going to give people housing? All of that. But in well-located areas, connecting it to something other than just brick and mortar, to a whole life, to your life, access to a good school, access to a good clinic, access to a park.
Yeah.
That's not stuff that I think people are talking about. So I think that's one of the things we view as.
And those shifts in policy or power.
Yeah.
The moving from a position of selling the thing to a private developer to a position of stopping stalling the sale, and then to a position of conducting your own feasibility study. Would you see all that as successes of it and using the policy and interventions?
I guess it's also disturbing how litigation in many sectors, like from education to health to housing, it always gets to a point where you have to go to court before the state reacts. policy exists, but the problem isn't policy,
yeah.
which is the most frustrating part, you know,
it's
implementation of the policy. We do view this as a success in the fact that there's a reaction, there's a consideration of something that was not even being considered before on that site. But we do think that the premier is also trying to, we think that the outcome of this feasibility study will be, the site is huge to begin with. It will be, it will be a compromise between, so initially it was sold to the school, no strings attached, other than, okay, preserve the heritage site, which used to be an old school as well. But basically around the school building, there's like numerous amounts of land that we think was probably going to be for like commercial development by the purchaser. And we think the compromise might just be like certain portions of it are now allocated for social housing, but the school also gets the school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that, have you thought that far ahead in terms of tech, what becomes acceptable and where you move to next?
Oh yeah, like through conducting this study, through looking, assessing social, and all of this is new to us, like it's freaking, it's experimental. Like just looking at, speaking to Malcolm, looking at the social housing budgets and all of that, like to advocate fully for social housing on that side is like unfeasible. That's like, that was, I think, gung-ho, like, hell no, we won't go kind of vibe. Like, it's going to be exclusive, but it wouldn't be sustainable. It wouldn't be possible. It wouldn't be feasible. So there has to be some form of cross-subsidization. So there has to be a commercial element there, for sure. I think if this, yeah, I don't know, Julian and Martha are working on it. We don't completely negate the idea of the school being on the site. But there has to be like a large social housing component on that side.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has to be a mixed use.
It's really, I'm sure conditions wise there are a lot of differences, but structurally and power and private,
yeah,
public and all that,
yeah,
the sites and all this,
is it?
It is very, very, very similar.
Yeah.
Where we're at with,
yeah,
with this.
And that's, I mean, that's a conversation that we've been having. Like, this is, It's a global trend, right? Like the market is the thing. In the case of Bromwell, for example, one of the counselor for human settlements at the municipal level, her name is Benedicta Van Minnen. I think she was being interviewed by a journalist, and I think she was asked about the trends in Woodstock and gentrification and displacement and all of that. What did she say? It was fascinating. What was hilarious, actually, it was, the state cannot, what did she say? It was something about like the state cannot control market forces. And what is at play here? Those are market forces. So it's like, what is the role of the state if not to have some semblance of control and regulations and things like that? Basically, it's like a free for all is what you're saying. And yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a good indicator of where she's at.
Ideology, and it's,
yeah,
that's it. Like, some people are, I think, within government, are more diplomatic than that. But generally, what she said, that's it. That is the belief. That's the ideology.
Yeah. Fantastic. That's a big old man.
We should leave soon.
For the park.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Okay, are we going to Gavin?
He's gone already, but I'll go with you.
That was brilliant. Do you have anything you want to ask us before?
I would like a proper sit down, not 15 minutes, but
yeah,
a proper.
Okay.
But okay.
We'll get a coffee at some stage, maybe after this.
I have a meeting in Kailicha actually on Monday morning. You said you're going on Tuesday afternoon to SJC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're working it out too, so we're going to maybe split up a bit.
Okay.
If rather than saying no to meetings, we're going to split up and get as much.
We've got like people with cars, so if you need a car, then we can take you wherever it is that you need to go, if you need to go somewhere else.
If it was driving, I would probably do it then. If it's,
yeah,
if it's abseiling or paragliding, something.
Okay. But I guess it's just, I went to the video that you sent me The land? Back then.
That was just before the elections.
Really?
Yeah. We always do something to upset people before elections.
So you were asking about the, so we had municipal elections. August pre-elections. They shook everything up. They shook everything up. Like I said, the African National Congress, they've been in power since forever. The only provinces that they don't control, the Western Cape. This was DA run. And the only metros that they didn't control, City of Cape Town. This past elections, people have had it. They have had it with their empty promises, the political rhetoric, and all of that. So they lost like a lot of meat. They lost the city of Joburg, which was like devastating for some of us. I'm not like affiliated with any political party, but it was shocking. They lost Tshwane, which is where, which is like the capital. They lost, which one was the big, they lost a lot of municipalities.
And did they lose them all to the freedom, what do you call them?
The EFF?
The EFF?
Freedom Fighters.
Or any, who did?
So they lost, they lost Nelson Mandela Bay, which is in PE. Apparently that's one of the most, it's been a contentious one as well. They lost Nelson Mandela Bay to the DA.
Yeah.
They won the city of Joburg. But you have to get to 50%. They got like 40-something percent. So there's a coalition government. There was a coalition between the EFF and the DA. The DA was just below. So it's basically DA run, the city of Johannesburg. Tshwane is also now DA run. The city of Cape Town is DA run. So like all these major metros are now DA run. The EFF is the tipping point kind of thing. So everybody was kind of trying to woo them to be like, give us your 12% so that we can be your But it really shook things up.
So for someone campaigning on social justice issues, does it change in the electoral dynamics
Does it just mean those
who are in power are more aware, or does it change anything?
Or
you don't know yet? No.
I don't know.
I think it changes history. I mean, it changes what's familiar. Like, from a broad perspective, it changes the way we conceive of democracy. You know, democracy is freedom and rights and all of that, but like this was seeing it at play. I think we were so used to a particular way of being that isn't indomitable ANC could actually be shaken up. So I think it changes public, it changes discourse, it changes a lot of things, I think. It really does. But in terms of practically implementation, socioeconomic rights, delivery, I really don't know. I mean, the DA is known for delivering, but for me, their ideology is warped, you know. So the national elections are in 2019, so I'm actually quite curious to see how that plays out. Whether this would have been like a moment for the ANC to kind of rethink how, because they've gotten incredibly bad. To see if this real if this will check themselves. And a lot of people didn't vote. That's the thing. I think a lot of people are just like, they've had it. And because I think there was a great conversation about what happened this time. So the argument is that a lot of the DA supporters or constituencies that normally stayed away from elections came out because they're like, fuck it. The ANC voters would not vote for any other party, but didn't vote either. So like basically the cards are stacked against them and very much for the DA. But a lot of people aren't heartbroken unless they're like a staunch ANC member. But a lot of people, I think, believe that this is just a moment in time to shake the ANC up a bit. But in 2019, we'll call them back again. But if they're not shaken up, then yeah.
Just like to get your act together 2 years.
Yeah, like I'm sure you've read in the paper like our beloved president and all his going ons and all of that. Yeah, and being defended by his party.
Yeah.
But in terms of these issues, I don't know. I think an assessment or that question, I think, would be more pertinent or more relevant to places like to organizations working in Johannesburg, because they will see, I'm sure, a difference.
Yeah.
Whereas for us, it's like business as usual.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me get this clarified.
What happens to you if you don't get the car on time?